Proverbs 27. The theme of this particular proverb is friendship. Friendship is the reoccurring theme here in this chapter, and there's a number of other exhortations as well, but a lot of them revolve around, preparing oneself to be a better friend in many respects. He opens up in the first three verses with issues on presumption and pride and envy. And then these opening remarks just lead into verse 4 and 5, which 5 and 6, which speak about the aspect of being a friend and faithful even to the wounds of a friend. And then he talks about a number of things that revolve around this. Now, he opens up in verse 1 by saying, "Don't boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day may bring forth." The idea here of tomorrow is something that the Bible speaks about frequently. The Bible says, don't worry about tomorrow. Each day has enough trouble of its own, Jesus said. The Bible speaks about not neglecting tomorrow, the wise plan for the future. But here you find this exhortation, do not boast about tomorrow. That is, take it for granted. You know, presume it's going to be there. For example, in the English, to think about procrastination would be a good example of boasting about tomorrow. For if I'm procrastinating, if I have something to do and I put it off to tomorrow, that presumes tomorrow will be there. That presumes everything's going to continue as it always has. I can count on tomorrow. It's no problem. And we put off tomorrow what we could have done today. The Spanish word mañana captures this even better. You know, mañana means tomorrow, and it can mean just literally tomorrow, or it can mean just, forget about it, mañana, one day. You know, we don't have to worry about it. No consequence. You know, when you think about this, as you order that extra large hot fudge sundae with the chocolate and the cream and the almonds, you excuse that indulgence thinking, well, I'll start my diet tomorrow. You know, we do that a lot, don't we? We make decisions today because we're boasting of tomorrow. We think, well, I've got tomorrow to straighten it out. I've got tomorrow to take care of it. You know, spiritually, it can be a problem. The Bible says, today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your heart. But how many people put off following the Lord till tomorrow? They think in terms of, well, I'm young now. You know, when I get older, I'll get religious. Or I'm not going to worry about this right now. I'll take care of that tomorrow. Or one day I will. Felix is a good example of that. Not Felix the cat, but in Acts chapter 24, verse 25, he was a man who was a governor there and overseeing Paul's imprisonment and went to talk to Paul, find out the situation. And the Bible says that Paul reasoned with him about righteousness, about judgment to come. And it says Felix was afraid. And he said, go away for now, and when I have a convenient time, I'll call for you. That's a perfect example of someone who's boasting of tomorrow. They think, when I have a convenient time, I'll deal with this situation. For many, tomorrow never comes. I think of people that were in the World Trade Center in that horrible, tragic moment when the planes hit. They were trapped, and tomorrow would never come. But they never had any conception of that happening as they were leaving for work that morning. They couldn't even imagine. They couldn't fathom in their wildest dreams that they would be unsafe in the two of the tallest buildings in the world. And yet, tomorrow. Now, to prepare for tomorrow is scriptural, but to boast about tomorrow is wrong. James speaks about the proud man who says, today or tomorrow we'll go into such and such a city and spend a little bit of time there and invest in it and we'll have a profit in a year. And he says, whereas you don't know what will happen the next day. You ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will do such and such. Tomorrow, I think of the man who was doing quite well in his business. And Jesus used this parable in Luke 12, where he speaks about this guy who everything was coming together. His flocks, his herds, and all of his crops were just exploding. And he says, I don't know what I'm going to do with all this stuff. He says, I know, I'll build bigger, better barns. And then when, you know, all this stuff is stored up, I can retire and I'll have many goods laid up for the future. And the Lord says, the angel spoke to him, fool, you don't know that this night your soul is required of you. Then who will these things be? So don't boast about tomorrow. You don't know what a day may bring forth. That's why you shouldn't boast. No one knows what tomorrow is. We have a desire always to know what's in store. People want to know the future, but none of us can. It seems to be that many people are drawn to their astrology charts or some fortune teller or someone that's going to tell them the future. All in such ways because we want to boast about tomorrow. We want to have guarantees. But one guarantee we do have is the Bible says he'll never leave us nor forsake us. So that no matter what happens when we're in his hands, it all comes together. In the next verse, he says, let another man praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. Now, another aspect of humility, not boasting about tomorrow, and here, not boasting in yourself. For example, someone once said, praise is a beautiful garment, but though you wear it, someone else has to put it on you, or it won't fit very well. It's something that you have to get from someone else. Now, why would someone boast of themselves? Why do we? Why do we want to drop dimes in front of others of all the accomplishments we have or the good things we've done? It's largely we're insecure. And we want to be noticed. Here it says, but don't let it come from your own lips. Let your own works testify for themselves and let someone else praise you. It's much more comely. Praise is beautiful in that respect. Now, in one respect, there's an example of Paul having to do some boasting in 2 Corinthians when he wrote to them. And he felt embarrassed in chapter 12, verse 11. He says, I've become a fool in boasting. He says, for you've compelled me. The problem was there were false teachers in Corinth who were saying, Paul the apostle, he's not really an apostle. He's nobody of consequence. And Paul, not because he had to show how great he was, but he had to set the record straight for the people's sake so they wouldn't follow these false guys. He had to stand up and take charge and say, hey, this is what I've done. This is what God has called me, and I'm not behind even the most eminent apostles, though he said, I am nothing. So it was necessary at that point. But as a general rule, let not your own lips praise you. A stone is heavy, verse 3, and sand is weighty, but a fool's wrath is heavier than both of them. What is it about a fool's wrath? Well, a fool, first of all, again, is all wrapped up in self. And when he's angered, he's wrathful, he loses his temper, it's because he's hurt. Somebody's let him down. Someone has inconvenienced him. So it's all revolved. In fact, think about the last time you were angry. Be honest with yourself. Were you angered in regard to somebody else that was hurt? And you were angered at the situation? Or were you angry because you were hurt? Somebody said something to you that hurt you, or somebody did something that embarrassed you, or whatever, and it was all about self. Isn't that often the time that when we're angry? But notice, a fool's wrath is heavier than both the weight and the sand and the stone. I have to think of times when God deals with me, and I'm going to be sharing a passage. I'm often tested in the very thing. It's inescapable for me. I mean, you think, oh, pastor, that's pretty hard. You're using that sword to cut. Well, just understand it has a two edges to it. And I get cut first before I cut you. I was leaving the house rather in a hurry about 4 days ago for a meeting. And my wife said, you want a cup of coffee before you go? I said, yeah, great. That'd be awesome. So she gives me a cup and I'm running out the door and I'm thinking, honey, I need a travel cup. You always do this to me. Why do you do this? I can predict it. So I'm running. I don't have no time to change it. So I put it on my seat. I try to get it so it won't fall over. And I'm driving down and I'm coming around this exit and I look and it starts to move. So I try to steady it. I take my eye off the road. I fly over this curb about 30 miles an hour. The coffee went everywhere along with a little dessert that she gave me. And I call her up on my cell phone. I say, I bet you'd like to know just what happened to me a few minutes ago. And I said, do you know that travel cup you didn't give me? Why didn't you give it to me? I'm losing it. And as if it's her fault that this happened. But this is a fool's wrath. It's weightier than stone and heavier than sand. But even beyond wrath and anger that so often we struggle with, notice verse 4. Wrath is cruel and anger a torrent. But who is able to stand before jealousy? In the Hebrew, this word jealousy is often also translated envy. Now, there is a difference between envy and jealousy, but they're very closely related because it all revolves around what, for example, jealousy is holding on to something that you don't want anyone else to have, so you're gripping it with whited knuckles. A man who is jealous over his girlfriend, for example, is like he wants to go beat up any other guy that's looking at her. He's afraid of losing her. If she's talking to somebody else, he's wondering, who are you talking to? Why are we talking to him? And this jealousy, of course, the world looks at that like, oh, how much he loves her. Look how jealous he is. No, he loves himself. Jealousy is not out of true love. It's out of self-love. I want her for myself. Now, envy is a little different. Envy is when someone else has something and you want it. You want it for yourself. But it's the same picture here. Now, why is it worse than wrath and anger? Why is it more deadly? Well, the Bible speaks about this very thing being the first, if you think about it, the first murder that occurred in the Bible was wrought because of envy. Abel saw his brother Cain's offering was accepted by God and his wasn't. He was angry. He went out and killed him. Now, why did he kill him? The Bible tells us why. Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. He was envious. I think of the family of Jacob. What happened in that family? The havoc that was brought upon that family because of envy. The brothers of Joseph were envious of his position. They were jealous that they were losing their position and envious over his position. It all wrapped up together and ended up selling him as a slave because of it. We're going to initially kill him. I think of all these different illustrations of a king that was fooled and tricked by the men in his kingdom to put Daniel in the lion's den because they were envious of Daniel. I think of Jesus. He was harassed by it. In fact, went to the cross because of envy. Pilate, who was he understood men, and he was quite impressed with Jesus, and he realized the reason they delivered Jesus up to him was because of envy. The crowds were following Jesus. And these self-righteous leaders, religious leaders, set him up. It comes from an emptiness or perceived lack of or fear of losing something. You know, but if we knew the gift of God, we wouldn't have any room in our heart for envy. If we knew what God had provided for us, why is it that we look out? We want something more. Good test for ourselves as to whether if envy is there. Do we love to see others excel? We could ask that question. Do we take joy in the prosperity and honor of others? Do we exalt in them as much as if others exalted us? Now, how hard that is, isn't it? When you find yourself chafing at someone else's promotion because you feel that should have been you, then you'll know what envy can do. And then maybe the temptation of you to slander them and say things that were bad about them because they didn't deserve it. How we get wrapped up into this world because of these character areas that God needs to develop in us. When I find that ugly envy rearing its head in my life, I need to deal with it. I need to chide myself. I need to say, you know what? You know, you have more than what God, I mean, more than you deserve. In fact, I remember his mercies are more than we deserve every morning. Why is it that we are not satisfied? Well, in order to really enter into the next few verses, these things, I believe, have to be taken care of. Because then we'll have the tender-heartedness to be able to understand the value of a true friend. Verse 5 says, open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. And faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. In these two verses, you see the picture of confronting a friend. But what is an ideal friend? When you think of an ideal friend, what comes to your mind? A groupie hovering about you, following your every move, wanting to hang with you, or one who is there for your best interests, even if they say something that hurts you? Which is a better friend? Do you want someone who likes you so much all they care about is hanging with you? That's far too short of a requirement for a true friend. We all have blind spots. You know, in the rear view mirror you have in the side mirror, you're looking in the mirrors to see who's behind you, but there's that blind spot and you can't see. And if you don't turn your head to double check, you know, you try to change lanes and you might run into them. Buses have blind spots in the front, so they put that little swinging arm out so the child has to walk around because otherwise a child could be right in front and they've been run over in the past. But when we're blind to ourselves in our own lives, we need someone who will be honest with us. We need people around us who will take a bullet for us at the same time yet speak the truth in love, even if it means temporary pain or embarrassment. You know, on a smaller scale, imagine yourself coming from a restaurant and you're rushing into a meeting and one of your friends stops you and says, hey, you better not go into the meeting that way. What? Well, you got this big piece of spinach right on your teeth. You better take care of that or you're going to look foolish. And now you're embarrassed. Oh, you know, and you're fixing yourself. You're embarrassed that someone had to point out that to you. But aren't you thankful? Aren't you happy that you didn't go into this very important business meeting with a piece of spinach in your teeth? How are you doing? Good to have you here. Spiritually, we all have blind spots. We don't see ourselves in particular areas. And the greater problem is when you're not close enough to anyone to have them point that out to you. Imagine going back to the spinach on your teeth. Imagine you went through the whole day and no one said anything to you. You get home and you go, I don't believe it. And you want to call up one of your friends, so-called friends now. Why didn't you tell me if you're my friend? Well, I didn't want to embarrass you. You know, here it is. Open rebuke is better than love carefully concealed. Better to have someone point out your faults that loves you rather than someone who admires you but doesn't want to risk inflicting any embarrassment or wound upon you because they want to be held in high esteem with you. I'm reminded of this little quick video clip that I have on my computer. I don't know who sent it to me, but it's a hilarious thing where these two altar boys are standing there holding candles. You might have seen this. And one of the altar boys starts to fall asleep while he's standing up, and he leans into the candle, and it catches his hair on fire. But the funny thing is watching the reaction of the other friend. He turns and he sees this, and he's like, he starts to do something, but then he's embarrassed. He doesn't want to risk, you know, any embarrassment for himself, so he goes back to holding his candle. And by now the flame starts growing, and the kid wakes up, you know, he starts getting it out. But it struck me as, if that guy was a friend, he'd have got his other friend's attention. But what is it about our self-centeredness that we don't want to risk being hurting someone, taking the hit ourselves or being embarrassed ourselves, so we don't say anything to anyone? We don't want to risk someone saying to us, well, that's none of your business. You know, I think when a true friend gets in that relationship, when you've got true friends, they're willing to tell you things. They're willing to get your attention. They're willing to shake you if they need to, whatever it takes. David had Nathan. And not many people are willing to point out a flaw to a king. You're risking your life. But Nathan was faithful enough to tell him, David, you're the man who's done this horrible sin. At this rebuke, whatever rebuke it is, though, and whatever wound of the friend is administered, you have to remember that there is a limit, too. You know, telling the fault between him and him alone is the key here. In fact, open rebuke is in reference not to public rebuke, but in regard to the sincerity of the heart. And unrestrained, you're going to be very honest and frank with someone. Now, a good sign of godliness is when you have the openness to have your faults pointed out. You know, because you can also send a message to people that you don't want anyone to say anything negative to you. And they won't. And you'll continue on in your delusion. A wise old saint once said, he who wants to be safe must have a faithful friend or a bitter enemy, that he may run from vice by the admonition of the one or by the attack of the other. Now, it's much better, obviously, to have a faithful friend, because wounds of a friend won't go beyond what is needful. You know, but a friend is willing to cut, is willing to hurt. In Michigan, when I hurt my knee in the wrestling room, had to go to the doctor. You know, the doctor spoke very compassionately to me, very positively, and I was really hopeful things were going to work out. And then he cut me. Can you believe that? He cut me. How dare he? Yet without that knee being opened up, it wouldn't have healed right. I would have been locked in position. It was all swollen. That cut was necessary. And spiritually, I believe that there are many needful wounds in our lives that we're going to have to endure. And if you run from them, or if you isolate yourself from godly friends, you're going to do it only to your own hurt. Because the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. Choose yourself. What would you rather prefer? Would you rather have someone kissing up to you and saying all these nice things about you, but they're only out for themselves? Or someone who is honest enough to say, hey, you know what I noticed the other day? Why don't you think about this area of your life? But you know they love you. I'll take the faithful wounds. Verse 7, a satisfied soul loathes the honeycomb, but to a hungry soul every bitter thing is sweet. Now this is just about cultivating a good appetite. If you're really hungry, you know the expression hunger is the best sauce. You're going to eat anything. But when you're filled, you don't even want dessert. Even the best of desserts that they put in front of you. No, I have no more room for it. Now, from a spiritual standpoint, if you don't cultivate a good appetite, for example, if you fill your mind with things that are just empty, TV and movies and radio and music all can titillate your senses, but then dull them to things that are essential. That's a problem. Like a bird that wanders, verse 8, from his nest is a man who wanders from his place. This is actually a very pathetic picture. Picture of a bird who, maybe through some sort of deformity, is wandering around not knowing where his nest is, not knowing where his home is. Yet there are many men. We talk about midlife crisis as if it's some sort of an oddity. It's just the flesh. You know, a man in his middle age years, you know, attempting to turn back the clock, trying to think, gee, do young women still find me attractive? They don't, but he still thinks that there's a possibility there. And he looks at the young women and he still fancies himself young, and he looks at his wife, she's getting older, and he begins to think, you know, there's got to be something better. And he begins to wander from his place. He forgets who he is. There's a lot of men in that position. You know, to know your place and be content is a very important thing, because it's the future for you. You know, here you don't know what the end result will be when you wander from that place. I think of David, who wandered from his place. He was supposed to be at the head of the army, and he finds himself in Jerusalem, in his palace, out on his balcony, when he should have been out to battle. And he got struck by a different kind of an arrow with his armor being off. An arrow of lust, seeing that beautiful Bathsheba there bathing. And he calls her up and he sins. He wandered from his place and all the pain that it cost him in his own family. If guys could only see 10 years down the road, wandering from their place now, what it will mean. Oh, they don't know the cost involved. They have no idea. And they make decisions like this every day, sadly enough. Ointment, verse 9, and perfume delight the heart. And the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel. You know, I love this passage here, this idea of hearty counsel, counsel of the soul, that someone who knows you enough to give you some good, wise counsel. It's like perfume. It's a delight. It smells great. It's something that's just so sweet to have a friend giving you good counsel. Now, some of you might have friends that are very, very close to you and would do anything for you. But when it comes to giving you godly counsel, they don't have it because they're not there. So you got a problem. You got a close friend, but no real hearty, good counsel for your soul. You might get bad counsel, you know, telling you ladies, why don't you leave the bum, you know, type of thing. And come out, and they take you out to the bars and the parties and say, come with us. You know, there'll be some guys out there that will appreciate you. So you put the makeup on, you look your best, not even that good for your husband, but you're going to look for your best when you go out with the girls. And the next thing you know, you're wandering from your place. But the point is, the counsel so often leads us into such decisions. When you have a good soul friend that is also godly, that's great. That's a great combination. So you can have a friend, but if they're not godly, that's a problem. Or you can have godly people around you, but if they're not close, that's a problem. Need to have close godly friends in your life. It's like sweetness of perfume. He says, don't forsake your own friend or your father's friend. Now, why would someone do that? Why would someone be tempted to forsake a long-standing friend of the family? I think sometimes that people make these decisions, and even in the shorter terms, because, well, they perceive an advantage with this person over there. I want to be their friend. And so they flit over there. And then when they get to that person, and then, you know, familiarity breeds contempt. They're like, oh, this is okay. Ooh, there's somebody more important over there. So they go from friend to friend to friend, just flitting to find a better advantage than sticking with longtime friends. Solomon stuck with a longtime friend of his father, Hiram. And it created a great relationship between the two of them and an established government in the area. Solomon's son, Rehoboam, did not. It cost him dearly as he listened to his peers and he rejected the wise counsel of his father's counselors and friends. And it cost him the kingdom. Don't forsake those long-standing friends. You know, sometimes even in a shorter term, you know, you go to a party or a retreat or something and you're talking to someone and they're looking over your shoulder at someone that they want to talk to that's more important to you. So they go to that person and then they go to the next person. They're always looking for someone important to talk to. You know, this is the type of mentality of someone who you need to know your place, to be friends with those people that God has raised in your path. He says, nor go to your brother's house in the day of your calamity. Now, your brother's going to take care of you, but if you're not close to them, you're putting it upon them. It's better is a neighbor nearby than a brother far away. Better someone that you've established relationships that are close. In fact, Jonathan was closer to David than David's own brothers. You know, that friendship that was very strong, that bond that was there. My son, be wise and make my heart glad that I may answer him who reproaches me. Solomon just expressing how important he wanted his son to be wise. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. A prudent man foresees evil and hides himself. The simple pass on and are punished. This is a great verse to put to memory. Because the prudence and the foresight to see the effect of our decisions ahead of time. Why is it that we get into a situation and we go, oh, if I'd only just listen to my, you know, the scriptures on this. If I'd only listen to the counsel of those who are telling me, don't go down this road. Oh, I could have saved myself a lot of pain. Well, prudence, you know, foresight. You see the evil ahead of time. I know that the lust might be attractive, but I know what the end result will be. I know the end result, where it's going to lead. So I'm not going to make that decision. But the simple pass on. They cannot figure out if they say this is going to happen. It kind of reminds me of the proverbial young husband. You know, he just gets married and it's hard for him to adjust to living with a woman. And, you know, he still thinks of the guys in the locker room. So he'll say hurtful thing and then never figure out why it's hurtful. Well, it's a big deal. You know, and she's like, well, if you don't know, I'm not going to tell you. He's like, I don't get these women, you know. But it's just that he has not put together, if I say this, then the result will be I'll be sleeping on the couch. But the wise are prudent. They go, you know, if I say these words, then I'll be on the couch tonight. So, all right, I'm going to hide myself from that. I'm not going to do it. The simple, they pass on. Blah, they're going to say it anyway. And they're going to be on the couch. Why not have wisdom? Take the garment of him who is surety for a stranger. And hold it in pledge when he is surety for a seductress. Now, this is an oft-repeated proverb about being surety or guarantee. Here, the counsel is, if you're foolish enough to guarantee for a stranger, and then they fail to pay the debt, now you have to pay it, then it's just that your garment is being taken from you, because you should not have done that. And it should be a pledge when it's a surety for a seductress. He who blesses his friend with a loud voice rising early in the morning, it will be counted as a curse to him. Now, I know you might have used this verse in a way that, I mean, I used to think about this, someone coming over early in the morning. Hey, how you doing? What's going on? Oh, keep your voice down. I just woke up. But that's not really what's being said here. What is actually being expressed here is a friend who is eager to bless early and often and is constantly proclaiming his faithfulness and his loyalty and blessings to you, it's almost overdone, you see. See, the overdoneness is the problem. You wonder if they really are a friend, because real friendships don't need constant assurances like that. One act of love is worth many loud blessings. A continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Now remember Solomon, he had lots of experience with plenty of women in his life. And that was the problem. You know, I think the challenge is as a husband to please one wife. I can't imagine trying to please more than one wife. I mean, that would be something that, Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now you wonder, well, why did God let him get away with that? Well, ask yourself, why does God let you get away with the things you do? He gives you space to repent. Solomon, it cost him dearly to have this many women in his life. And of course, this was his attitude as a result of it. I mean, I can't imagine, you know, the continual dripping with 700 women. He must have had lots of floods and torrents in his life trying to deal with all these women. He goes on to say, he who restrains her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. I mean, he couldn't control one woman, let alone 700. As iron sharpens iron, so a man sharpens the countenance of his friend. You know, I can't emphasize the importance enough about how we need to have relationships in our lives that are godly. in order for our lives to be sharpened. Because there is a dullness that can occur intellectually, morally, spiritually in our life. There is a spiritual bluntness that creates a difficulty in us. We don't see ourselves. We don't see that fault. We're dull. And when we want to be used of God, we wonder why it takes so much energy, why it takes so much out of us to follow the Lord. Because we're not sharpened. We're working 10 times harder than we need to. This guy's got this very dull axe, and he's out there hacking away at this tree, and it's taking him forever to chop down the tree that another one with a very sharp axe comes along and just zips right through it. See, I want to have a sharpness in my life, and I know that in order for that to be so, iron sharpens iron. So one man is sharpened by the countenance of his friend. When I used to drywall, I wanted to keep my tools very sharp, and I would use a file to file them very sharp. The drywall blade is not a blade like a knife blade where you want sharp in that sense to cut, but you want a nice flat edge, a sharp corner on the edge. So I would file them nice and flat, get those sharp edge corners, and then it would make the job so much easier. Well, iron is used to sharpen iron. So God uses others in our lives to sharpen us. More mature individuals that can mentor us. Not afraid of us. Not intimidated by us. That can tell us what we need to hear. You know, I've often said to even the leaders in the fellowship and the people that are involved here in ministry. When we first got started, especially, no one knew about Calvary Chapel at the time and Chuck Smith. And, you know, there's always questions as you're going in a direction. You know, is this right? Are we doing the right thing? Are we, you know, is the pastor going in the right direction here? And I shared with some of these leaders, I said, look, if there's any question you ever have about the practices, the direction we're going as a fellowship, I give you permission ahead of time to call some of these mentors. Call Gail Irwin, Don McClure, Raul Reese, Chuck Smith. Call these guys and rat on me. Tell on me. Bust on me. I don't care. You have my permission ahead of time to call them. You won't be going around because I'm telling you ahead of time, go ahead to call. Now, what that did was it created an atmosphere where they had some guys they could go to. And these guys that knew me well, if I was doing something wrong, they would call me to the carpet. Say, hey, you know what? That's not a good idea. I wouldn't do that because of this or that. They've got more experience and wisdom. And you learn that way. But it also gave these leaders an opportunity to realize that, hey, there's, you know, these guys are going to know. And so therefore they have an assurance that if I'm going in the right direction, they've got that other assurance. The whole point of it was that it's relationships. I have godly men in my life that I can tell my sin to. And that's a good question. Do you? Do you have godly people in your life that you can tell anything that you're struggling with to? That's very, very important. Otherwise, you'll be isolated and you will not have the sharpness that you need. Whoever keeps the fig tree will eat its fruit. Just common sense. You take care of the tree, you're going to have its fruit. Take care of your life, you're going to see the fruit in your life. So is he who waits on his master will be honored. You're faithful in what you're doing, you'll see the repercussion for good. As in water, face reflects face, so a man's heart reveals the man. Now, a mirror can reveal your face, but a mirror cannot reveal your heart. You know, the heart of a man reveals what he is. You don't see a heart. I don't see your hearts. I can't judge your hearts. I see what's on the surface. I can see, however, what the actions of a person's life are. I can see the fruit of that. But the heart reveals who you really are. So if you're not in any close proximity to someone to be able to share your heart, then you know what? You're plastic. You're not real. The real you isn't coming forth. Hell and destruction are never full, so the eyes of man are never satisfied. This is an understanding, again, coming back to human nature and understanding yourself. We've got to understand this principle. No matter what you have, you're going to be tempted for more. You got a beautiful wife, you're going to be tempted at younger, beautiful, more beautiful women. If you've got a handsome husband, you'll be tempted at more handsome men out there, more debonair, more thoughtful, more caring, more compassionate. There's always going to be something more. You've got good friends, you're going to be wanting better friends. You've got a good job, you want a better job. You're making good money, you want more money. You've got to drive a nice car. You just get this brand new car you're all proud of until somebody drives down by with a nicer car. Like, well, mine's better, you know. But deep down, you know, I'd love to have that. What is it about our eyes? You know, the world revolves around, the whole world is made up of images. TV and movies, all the images that we get bombarded with constantly to create displeasure with ourselves so that we will buy product A, B, and C. I mean, all the commercials are made to create a dissatisfaction. You know, I never thought about my breath until I saw the commercial. Then I'm like, okay, I better get that product. How much commercials make you think of yourself, make you think of what you need, and your eyes are never satisfied. You always want more. Now, if you understand this about yourself, you'll be able to chide yourself when you need to. You'll be able to say, aha, I know where this is coming from. I want that, but I know it's just my heart nature, and Lord, give me a contentment. The refining pot is for silver and the furnace for gold, and a man is valued by what others say of him. Now, the word valued there, if you notice, it's italicized, which means that is not in the original. The translators are putting that in there to try to convey what the meaning is being expressed. The unfortunate thing in this particular context, the word valued is not the best word here. The better word would be tested, because the context is testing. The refining pot is for silver, the furnace for gold. That's like a purging process. So a man is purged or tested by what others say of him. See, when others are talking about you, there's going to be both praise and criticism. Now, both of those are tests. If someone praises you, you're going to be tempted to get proud and lifted up and think more of yourself than you should. If someone criticizes you, you'll be tempted to be depressed and take it personal and hate them and be frustrated. See, the idea is to learn how to receive both praise and criticism in the right context. And you're tested by that. Though you grind a fool in a mortar, however, in those verse 22, with a pestle along with crushed grain, yet his foolishness will not depart from him. The idea is, no matter what, a fool isn't going to get it. Because he's so self-absorbed that he can't receive and can't understand. And from verse 23 through verse 27, Solomon concludes with these thoughts about being diligent to watch over the state of your flocks. Now, in that agricultural society, those things were pertinent to their future. If they wouldn't take close care of the grain that's being grown or the animals that they were watching over, if they're not diligent to watch closely, it will cost them their future. Same thing that I think you can apply in your own life. If you're not diligent with your work, you'll be out of a job. If you're not diligent in relationships, you'll be out of friends. Be content to know the state of your flocks and attend to your herds, for riches are not forever. Nor does a crown endure to all generations. When the hay is removed and the tender grass shows itself and the herbs of the mountains are gathered in. In other words, even just the worthlessness of hay has its value, because he says the lambs will provide for your clothing. And the goats the price of the field, and you'll have enough goat's milk for your food and the food of your household and the nourishment of your maidservants. It's just putting the correlation together. Being faithful in those little things in your life will one day bring forth very fruitful things, many more things. But if you're not faithful in looking at the hay and making sure the grass is there and getting the animals out to at the right time, getting to work on time, being faithful with your commitments, being involved in the church so that you can get plugged in. And all these areas are so essential. You've got to decide. Those small decisions you make, they will turn out to be big things later on. It's those little decisions. I'll give you one example, and I think that a word of the wise will be sufficient. I want to get up early. I want to spend that time with the Lord in the morning. I found one very important decision that helps that along. The decision is when to go to bed. Now, it seems like that little tiny decision in the evening affects the desire and the decision of waking up early in the morning to have time alone with God. So I need to think ahead to make a decision in the little thing. You know what? Do I need to stay up and watch the news right now? Do I need to stay up and watch this report or this? Do I need to, you know, stay up and way beyond the time? No, I need to go to bed because that time in the morning is more valuable. But how much time I can fritter, you know, in those evening hours, and then it costs me that time in the morning. It's those types of decisions that make or break a person. The little things that have a great impact on you. How many of you have, without raising your hand, regular morning devotions where you're really setting the time aside to hear from God, to open His Word and to remember maybe the verse to remember, or just having a verse that God is speaking to your heart about, or a chapter a day that you're reading? If you don't have that, do you know what repercussions happen later on with the decisions in that day? And then as that day gets shot, how that affects the next day? So many things turn, like Solomon says, on the little decisions that we make, the little nuances of life. And I pray that we take the time to cultivate those godly friends that can challenge us in these areas. I got to tell you, I did not have personal devotions until a man at Michigan State University got in my face and said, "What did you read in the Bible this morning?" And I was like, I haven't read yet." And he looked at me and he said, "You better read in the morning or you'll never read throughout the day." And I'm like, "Yes, sir." I was like, "Okay." But I thank God that he challenged me personally. You know what I did the next day? I got up and I read the Bible. I was challenged. I didn't want him to ask me ever again and me to stand there going, nothing. And I'll tell you, if you don't have people like that in your life, you got to start there. Cultivate friendships with godly people. Too many Christians are isolated from such eye-to-eye, face-to-face contact. People that love them and want the best for them. Godly friendships. God help us in this area.